It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This Sunday is Father's Day, and throughout the past week, we asked you to call in and share the best advice you ever got from your father. Well, we're playing those messages now during the show, and here's one of them.
My name is Patrick Kearns. I'm calling from Delavan, Wisconsin. The best advice I think my father handed out was when I was younger and get mad and wouldn't know what to do with that anger or the pent-up frustration. My father would say, write it down. Write it all out. Put it into a document. And then sleep on that document, take a look at it the next day, and then throw it away. I think his real advice was never send it. Write it so you can get all that anger out and then get rid of it. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Patrick, thank you so much for that story. And you can share your stories, continue the conversation over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we'll speak with U.S. Secretary of Labor Tom Perez about the changing role of men at home and in the workplace and how life has changed for parents during the last 50 years.
Our next guest has spent years interviewing young juveniles in and out of detention facilities. The result is an inside look at the lives of incarcerated children. She says many juveniles are in prison because of low-level crimes and that any path toward rehabilitation is effectively blocked by the institution of juvenile prison itself.
Nell Bernstein joins us now. She's the author of Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. Nell, welcome to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
Well, if there is such a thing, can you give us a profile of the typical resident of a juvenile prison?
You know, my first instinct is to say no, because having met so many kids who've had this experience, they're as varied as any individual. But with that as a caveat, there are a couple of things that they have in common. One is trauma. The great majority of them have experienced trauma in their early childhood and go on to experience more while they're incarcerated. The other thing is a high likelihood that they will be black or brown and poor because of significant disparate treatment throughout the system.
And what kinds of things have these kids done to land in prison or juvenile detention?
Well, you know, I think there's a general perception that once you put on that jumpsuit, it means you're an axe murderer. But again, the majority of kids who are incarcerated, especially for the first time, have committed not only nonviolent offenses, but very low-level offenses, things like truancy, running away, breaking a school rule, maybe a marijuana charge.
This book is largely based on interviews you did, relationships you forged with kids, young adults who have been in the system like this. Could you tell us one of their stories?
Oh, there's so many. I will tell you a story about an experience inside a juvenile facility, but again, with the caveat that their stories begin long before they're incarcerated and continue after. But I was fortunate to have a young man working with me as a research assistant, a UC Berkeley student who had spent 6 years in the California Youth Authority and was sort of considered a model prisoner. But he described to me a basketball game in which things got heated and he got into a fight. And the guards responded by taking a pepper spray fogger, some kind of what they call a chemical restraint, but similar to pepper spray, meant to clear a room, and spraying it point blank in his eyes and then putting him in solitary confinement for a month. And I asked him, how did you get through that month? Because international standards consider any amount of time in solitary confinement for juveniles to be torture. And he talked about hope. He said he very consciously thought about, what is my mother doing right now? What's the first meal that I'm going to eat when I got out? And he came through, obviously, in relatively good shape, but it took a conscious effort. And he also described the lingering psychological effects of his incarceration, that even though he seemed on the surface to be doing very well, he didn't feel comfortable if nobody was watching him. He always wanted somebody to be telling him what to do, and that's because life inside a juvenile prison is so regimented. You're not allowed to make any decisions. So when he got to college, and you're supposed to be becoming an adult and making decisions, it was difficult and, I think, confusing for him.
Well, you talk about how he survived by relying on a sense of hope. Did the young people that you talked to, did they, most of them, get out of juvenile detention with a sense of hope intact? Had they been rehabilitated? Were they whole people?
No. I think one of the most tragic statistics that I came across is that the greatest predictor that any given kid will wind up as an adult prisoner, so, you know, wind up committing criminal acts and being in prison as an adult, isn't family dysfunction or mental health issues or drugs or whatever we expect it to be. The greatest predictor of adult incarceration is juvenile incarceration. And, you know, it's easy to say, well, that's because they've just always committed crimes. But the other thing that researchers have found is that in confidential interviews, 80 to 90% of all American teenagers will acknowledge committing some kind of delinquent act or acts serious enough under the law to get them incarcerated. So basically, we're not talking about two groups of kids, the delinquents and the non-delinquents. We're really talking about those who are incarcerated and those who aren't in terms of their life chances. And those who are incarcerated face much dimmer life chances.
Well, when you're talking about a young person, a child by law who has been incarcerated, they have a lot of life left ahead of them, presumably, and the hope would be to rehabilitate them, to direct them toward a productive life, to contribute to society. Is that possible? Did you see that happening in the institutions that you visited? Is there a pathway forward?
There are always kids who find their own paths, but the reason the book has the title it does is that I don't think so. When you look at the fact that being locked up as a juvenile, and that's controlling for delinquency, controlling for a number of other factors, doubles the chances that you'll wind up in prison as an adult. And the fact that the abuses that we see inside these facilities date back to the 1800s, when we first began institutionalizing children, I ultimately came to conclude that it wasn't fixable. The problems intrinsic to isolating kids were part and parcel of isolating kids.
And in the institutions that you visited, the majority of them, how do they go about rehabilitating someone?
Well, you know, I visited the better facilities in general for the simple reason that those were the ones that were more interested in having me visit. So I did visit institutions where they were trying to implement some sort of a therapeutic program. And, you know, some of them were quite good. But ultimately, I came away feeling like there were some pretty deep internal contradictions there. Because, you know, if you think about if you or I were to go into therapy, there are certain things that we count on, like confidentiality, privacy, trust. But when the person who is either leading your therapeutic group or sending you to it has the key to your cell, that creates, I think, a conflict that you just can't get beyond. And that's in a best-case scenario. Some kids talked about, you know, this is supposed to be group therapy, but if I don't participate the way they want, or if my story doesn't match my official record, I get a write-up, and that means I could actually do more time. So when it's used in combination with a punitive mindset, you know, I think that kind of dooms the endeavor.
We're talking about juvenile prison with journalist Nell Bernstein. She's the author of the new book, Burning Down the House, and All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about juvenile prison with journalist Nell Bernstein. She's the author of All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. And her new book, the one we're talking about right now, is called Burning Down the House.
And you can join the conversation. Have you been in juvenile detention? Have you worked in one of those facilities? Have you been a social worker working with juveniles in and out of detention? Does it set children on a good path or set them up to end up in prison later on? What, if anything, would you like to see change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our phones right now. We've got Lindsay joining us from Madison. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi. Yeah, I was just calling. Me and my sister both grew up in the juvenile delinquent system, and she was in and out of juvenile detention centers throughout her juvenile years, and I was actually in and out of foster homes and group homes that provided treatment. And as an adult, she has continued that path of that institutionalization where she's been in and out of the prison system. I actually currently just graduated my master's in social work, and people often ask, you know, what's the difference? They kind of grew up in the same home. Both had, you know, we grew up poor. There's trauma. There's, you know, a lot of the similar things. And I do think that was one of the big contributors. You know, she would go into the juvenile prisons and then she'd go right back out into society. And she never received mental health treatment, any sort of therapeutic treatment, whereas I was able to get those tools as a juvenile and kind of apply them into adulthood.
Well, congratulations on your master's, Lindsay, and thank you so much for sharing your story. Appreciate that.
Yeah, that was a really important comment. Thank you for two reasons. One, it underscores the fact that people are individuals and that what happens to you doesn't predetermine your future. But also, when I talk to kids about what protected or rehabilitated them, they always talked about relationships. There was at least one adult who they could trust in their life, and it generally was an ongoing relationship. I also wanted quickly to clarify, my book isn't about juvenile detention centers in the sense of local juvenile halls. I really focus on the large state-run prison-like facilities, and just wanted to make that distinction.
And now one thing you point out, you're for evidence-based rehabilitation. And one thing you say is really key to this is keeping these kids in contact with their communities and support, having supportive adults around who can work with them, be there for them on a round-the-clock basis for at least for a little while. And that seems to be a striking feature of what works. And it sounds like that's what worked for Lindsay. What is it about that is more effective?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is the notion that I just raised, that it's relationship that rehabilitates, and that these community-based, evidence-based programs rely on two kinds of relationships. One is with a caseworker who, in some cases, is literally available around the clock. The other is they focus on bolstering and supporting existing relationships, because if a kid comes from a troubled family and goes into the system briefly, that child goes back to the same family. So the programs that work with the child in the context of his family, understanding that it's the whole system that may need to change and be supported for that child to grow up in a healthier way.
And you tell a story, well, actually it comes up again and again in your book about these young people who have been in juvenile prison, that they are treated like animals. And there's a story you tell about a young man who ended up entering a fight that sounds like he wasn't involved in it, but he ended up kneeling, chained to other inmates for a couple of weeks. Can you talk a little bit about the treatment that happens behind, I guess, away from the eyes of the world?
Yeah, it's really astonishing. Even by official federal numbers, about a third of kids in these large state facilities experience physical abuse and 12% experience sexual abuse. And I think we tend to think that that's at the hands of other wards. You know, we make don't drop the soap jokes. But out of that 12%, 10% of all wards are actually sexually abused by guards, by their protectors and by their keepers. The story that you mentioned was a young man whose unit was involved in a fight, and the whole unit was forced to strip to their boxers, be cuffed, and kneel with, I think, 3-hour breaks for what felt to him what he thought was 2 full weeks. And it's funny, I've told that story, and sometimes people will say, that can't be. That's just not true. And whenever I could, I tried to verify kids' stories with official records. And what I often found was that what was documented was worse than what they were telling me. In this kid's case, not only were kids being forced to kneel for long periods, they were being forced to kneel on sharp objects. So some pretty dark things going on inside these places that are meant to rehabilitate young people.
And one thing we do know is that this is expensive. It's expensive to incarcerate the large numbers of young people that are incarcerated. What do you know about the numbers?
Well, it costs on average $88,000 to incarcerate a young person for a year. And by way of comparison, it costs about $10,000 to educate a child. In California, where I live, it got as high as $225,000 a year for each kid in our juvenile prisons, as opposed to $8,000 and something for kids in the schools. The only positive side to the incredible expense that we're paying for something that doesn't work is that I think that's played a significant part in beginning to turn the tide. The number of kids in these facilities has dropped about 40% over the course of a decade, and that's a very significant drop, and I think in great part has been motivated by just the inability to balance state budgets.
Now, your book is called Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. I take it you're not very hopeful that such a thing will happen, but one reason that it could occur would be the cost of it, but how hopeful are you for reform?
Well, that's an interesting question. How hopeful am I for reform or for the end of the juvenile prison? Because one thing I discovered is that we have literally been reforming these institutions from their very inception. So the process of a scandal or a lawsuit, an investigation, a consent decree, promises of reform, I'm not hopeful about that. There are institutions like Dozier in Florida where they went through at least 12 of these cycles of investigation and reform. And today, forensic researchers are digging up bodies behind the institution. The 40% drop makes me very hopeful. But I still struggle with the question of what it is that we get from this particular intervention, since it's pretty widely known that it doesn't work. In other words, why do we remain psychologically invested in it? And I think until we get to that level, which I think requires just getting to know the kids and really understanding their humanity, I think until that happens, we will continue to put children in cages.
Nell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Nell Bernstein, a journalist and the author of Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison, and also of All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get tips for cooking with fresh herbs coming up in our gardens.
First, this Sunday is Father's Day, and throughout the show today, we're playing messages that you left us during the week about the greatest lessons you've learned from your dads. Here's Josie.
Hi, my name is Josie from Madison, Wisconsin, and I'm calling to tell the best advice my father ever gave me, which was, to never make fun of people for things they can't change. Thank you.
We heard there from a listener named Josie. You can continue that conversation on our Facebook page.
Now, fathers, all parents really understand the challenges of balancing work and home life. That was the message from New York Mets second baseman Daniel Murphy when he spoke at a White House fatherhood summit earlier this week. He sparked a debate nationally when he missed the first two games of the season for his son's birth.
Murphy's desire to take time away from work for family is one shared increasingly by men around the country. In a recent Boston College survey, 77% of men said they wish they had more time with their kids, and more than half the men said that if finances permitted, they'd give up their jobs and stay home with their children.
Policies don't always align with that desire to spend more time as dads. A fifth of American men have access to paternity leave, compared to a third of women in maternity leave. And overall, American parents are the only ones in the high-income world without universal access to paid parental leave.
As we head into Father's Day weekend, U.S. Secretary of Labor Thomas Perez joins us to talk about what the Obama administration is doing to help working fathers.
Secretary Perez, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, we've seen a big change in family and work life over the last 4 or 5 decades. More women in the workforce, more men staying home or juggling a job and family. Many families, of course, have two working parents. Have we learned lessons along the way, along that shift?
Well, I think you're exactly right, Rob. The workplace has changed. Economy has changed. Technology's changed. Gender roles have changed. This isn't your father's fatherhood. And we now live in a modern family society, and one of my concerns is we're still living by a lot of the Leave It to Beaver rules. Workplace flexibility here in the United States is all too limited for all too many people. My daughter recently graduated from high school, and I needed to skip a cabinet meeting in order to attend that, and I was able to do so because I had the flexibility, and the president said it was okay. But all too many people across this country, they have to win the boss lottery in order to take their son or daughter to the doctor, or take their mother or father to the doctor, or to go to their son's recital or their daughter's recital. And you compare the United States with other industrialized nations, and we're really far behind on issues of workplace flexibility. There are only a few countries in the world, Swaziland, Lesotho, Papua New Guinea, and the United States of America. These are the only four nations that have no form of paid parental leave in the world. Well, and other countries have figured this out, and they figured out that you shouldn't have to choose between the family you love and the job that you need. And that's what we do all too frequently here in the United States.
Before we get into what companies can do, what the government might do, do we need a culture change, changing what we expect of fathers?
Well, I think we're seeing that culture change. More women are in the workplace, and I think that has helped to grow our economy. And more men are full-time caregivers. A generation ago, it was 1% of fathers were home full-time. We've moved up to 7%. And so we're seeing the culture change. And regrettably, today's policies have not kept pace with changing attitudes, changing practices, changing phenomenon. And that's why you see such increased stress. When I talk to parents across this country about the things that keep them up at night, this work-family balance is always at the top of the list, because too many parents are sending their kid to school sick because they have no choice. They have to go to work.
Well, the culture has changed. The reality has changed. But I don't know about expectations. You, on Monday, had New York Mets infielder Daniel Murphy. He sparked controversy. He spoke at the White House, but he had taken paternity leave very early in the season and got a lot of mockery in the sports world and beyond. Have we adjusted our expectations of fathers?
Well, I thought it was unfortunate that some folks chose to criticize a decision that he made. I thought he was heroic. The birth of my three children were the three most exciting and remarkable days of my life. And the notion that I would have missed it to be at a baseball park or to be at a workplace is unimaginable to me. And so I take my hat off to him. And I would note that, you know, part of the reason Daniel was able to do it is because in the collective bargaining agreement with Major League Baseball, he had the right to do it. And in today's society, all too frequently, people don't enjoy the benefits that come from collective bargaining because so many less people are unionized, and so they don't have those benefits. And he is really an example of the rights you get when you avail yourselves of collective bargaining. And I applaud him for what he did, even though I am not a Mets fan and never will be.
Well, in the absence of collective bargaining, what steps would you like to see companies take to make work schedules more flexible for dads or for parents in general, for that matter?
Well, we've seen a number of states take steps to provide for paid leave. And a number of studies in the aftermath of California, for instance, demonstrated that it had none of the ill effects that opponents had predicted. There have been studies of companies that voluntarily put in place progressive leave policies, and it showed actually for publicly traded companies that their stock value went up. And in fact, when you were the first company in your industry to do it, your stock value went up even more. Because if I'm a working parent and I'm looking at a new job, those are questions that I ask. You know, what is my company going to do if I need to take my daughter to the doctor or I want to go to my son's recital? These are real questions, and companies have recognized that this isn't simply the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do, and those companies are getting ahead.
Now, these jobs that have flexibility that we hear about are often middle-class, knowledge economy jobs. What about people who are working at lower wages, a business owner saying, hey, I need somebody at the front counter of my retail store, I need somebody on my light assembly line now, not at some random flexible time. Is flexibility a reality for those kind of jobs?
Well, and that's why collective bargaining is so important, because a lot of collective bargaining agreements have built in this flexibility in workplaces, retail sectors, manufacturing sectors, and elsewhere that give that flexibility. And so that sort of that the question that you ask, Rob, really illustrates yet again how I think collective bargaining can play a really important role.
Well, given that a lot of those workers don't have collective bargaining, probably aren't going to get it anytime soon, do you see a role for the federal government, for the Obama administration, and Congress, of course? What could change? What would you like to see from the federal government?
Well, there's a number of things that we're doing. In the immediate future, the president is hosting on the 23rd of June a Working Family Summit here in Washington, D.C., and we've hosted a half a dozen regional summits across the country. And it's amazing the attendance that we have gotten. It's amazing the feedback that we have gotten. And what we've heard consistently is this: we live in a modern family world, and we've got to get away from Leave It to Beaver policies. We're supporting at the Department of Labor funding to assist states that want to implement progressive leave policies. And again, there are a number of states that are experimenting. California and Connecticut are two states that have put in place progressive leave policies, and we have seen that those policies have been very well received. California and New Jersey, for instance, provide 6 weeks of paid family leave, and it's funded through very easy means. And so companies that were surveyed recently showed that while they had concerns initially, those concerns have not come to pass.
Is this something that the president can do with an executive order, or does he need to get Congress to pass it? And if so, is there going to be bipartisan support to make that happen in both houses?
Well, there was bipartisan support 20 years ago or so when the Family Medical Leave Act passed, and that has become part of the American fabric. And the challenge with the family medical leave is that it's unpaid, and that puts us at a competitive disadvantage with the rest of the world. This is really bread and butter for parents and families across America. And we want people not only to make enough money to put food on the table. We want people to be home at the table eating with their children. And, you know, the failure to pass the minimum wage and the flatness of wage growth, too many people are not at the dinner table because they got to work a second and a third job. And others don't have the flexibility because if they got to take a couple hours off, they get docked. And so they have to choose the job that they need over the family that they love.
You mentioned the Family, Medical, and Leave Act and the required unpaid leave. That also only applies to, I think, about 60% of workers because it only applies to larger employers. Would you like to see that provision expanded to include more employers and their employees?
Sure. I mean, we're working to expand the reach of the Family Medical Leave Act. And also, again, I think paid leave is very important. I mean, for all too many Americans here, the Family Medical Leave Act is effectively irrelevant because they simply can't afford to take even a day off of unpaid leave, let alone any more than that. And so people who are working low-wage jobs, they really have no recourse. That's why Connecticut and California and others who have put in place paid leave systems are really ahead of the curve, and I think that's where the nation will be. Change. I'm a civil rights lawyer and a labor rights lawyer. I look at some of the most important laws we've put in place in our nation's history, and they've taken time. This is the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It was first introduced in 1948, and I'm confident that there were people who said, this is awful for America. And we know now today that those people were wrong. It's part of the American landscape of opportunity. And I think paid leave is part of today's and hopefully tomorrow's landscape of opportunity for working families who are struggling to make ends meet, who need that flexibility in the modern workplace to attend to their most sacred obligation to be a good parent and also attend at the same time to their obligations in the workplace.
More broadly, you mentioned the minimum wage. We hear a lot about wealth gap, income gap in this country. Over the next few years, what do you see as the employment and income prospects for people, you know, at the medium or lower family income?
Well, I'm bullish about the future for the following reason. I speak to employers across this country, including Wisconsin, and they are they're very bullish about the future. I spoke to manufacturers, for instance, in Wisconsin a few months ago when I visited, and they want to bring business back home, those who have a global footprint. They need workers with skills. We talked a lot about the skilled trades in Wisconsin. The average age, they told me, of a person in the skilled trades in Wisconsin is 59 years old. They're nearing retirement. There's opportunities for young people to grow into these jobs in the skilled trades that pay a middle-class wage and enable you to have ladders of opportunity. And we also have to make sure that we reward work by paying a fair wage. That's why we're fighting so hard to raise the minimum wage. And so many states have done so, most recently Vermont a few days ago, where the governor signed an increase in the minimum wage. 11 states in the last year have signed increases in the minimum wage. You know, Wisconsin was once a pretty progressive state in terms of wage fairness, and I hope it will again become a progressive state in that area, because too many people are working a full-time job and living in poverty in Wisconsin and across the country, and that's not who we are as a nation.
Secretary Perez, thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Have a nice day.
We've been speaking with U.S. Secretary of Labor Thomas Perez about the challenge American parents are facing to balance work and home life.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This Sunday is Father's Day, and during the show today, we're hearing the lessons you learned from your dads. You've been leaving us your messages throughout the week. This one comes from KB.
Greetings. It's KB from Hoka, Minnesota. And this Father's Day weekend, the one that always comes up on a regular basis is the shortest pencil is more reliable than the longest memory. Thanks. Have a great day.
Thanks for that message. You can continue that conversation on our Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's June, and a lot of our spring planting is behind us, which means it's time to start cooking. Herbs are already growing, and our next guest has some ideas on how to punch up our cooking using the fresh herbs we've picked right out of the garden.
Ian Knauer joins us again. He's a chef, TV host, and author. His latest cookbook is called The Farm, and he hosts a PBS show by the same name. Ian, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Well, herbs are starting to pop up in our gardens, and I know you're a big herb booster. What do you like about cooking with them?
Just about everything. And and I have to say that cooking with herbs is probably the easiest way to elevate your cooking. You know, if you look at chef's menus, they're always herb heavy. And that's because it's really the simplest way to get extra flavor into your dishes.
What are the must-have herbs in your garden or in pots on your back porch or wherever?
Well, I think you absolutely need thyme, rosemary, oregano, parsley, and chives. Those are the five that you can't live without. And anything on top of that is gravy. If you have a place to put sage or lavender or tarragon is one of my favorites, then throw them in there as well.
Do you have a favorite from among that select group there?
Oh, that's so hard to choose.
You could only cook with one herb for the rest of your life.
Right. You're on Iron Chef. Yep. They throw one herb at you. What do you want?
And probably parsley. It's the most versatile.
Parsley.
It can be used in stocks and soups. It can be used as a garnish. It adds a lot of flavor wherever you put it. And beautiful color, too.
I never think of parsley as having any flavor. Parsley has flavor?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it's a flavor that goes well in a lot of different cuisines, too. I mean, of course, the French use it heavily. But it's, you know, it's also used in Italian cooking, Mediterranean cooking, Scandinavian cooking, even Eastern European cooking.
So when using fresh herbs, I'm always in a bit of a quandary if a lot of heat is involved. Do I get them up front so the flavor has a long time to seep in, or put them in right toward the end so I don't cook out the flavor? I never know.
Well, you know, it depends what you're looking for. So if you're making a soup or a stock, my feeling is that if you throw the herbs in there, it doesn't matter whether it's in the beginning of the cooking time or closer to the end of the cooking time. Because they'll become a lot more subtle and they'll sort of blend in with the rest of the flavors. But herbs are the kind of thing that you can also add for a fresh note at the end. And I think that's where they really elevate home cooking, especially. So if you have a bunch of herbs, I would, in fact, use them both ways. Let's say you have a big bunch of parsley. You can throw half of it in your stock in the beginning. And then once your soup is ready to go to the table, you finely chop some of the leaves and put them on as a garnish.
And we got to ask you, you sent us some recipes, and one of them is an herb-rubbed roast chicken. Can you walk us through that one and what you like about it?
Yeah, so the thing that is really intriguing about this recipe is that it relies heavily on bay leaves. The bay leaves are one of the herbs that we often, you know, you throw one bay leaf in a soup or you throw them in a stock, and you don't really realize how potent they can be. But in this recipe, you grind them up in a spice grinder. Often, you know, you'll take that bay leaf that you put in the stock, you'll take it out then at the end because you don't want someone to eat it and choke on it. But when you grind bay leaves to a powder, they become a super intense flavor. And when you rub them on something like roast chicken, it takes a regular roast chicken and it makes it taste like a rotisserie chicken that's been cooking at a low, slow temperature for hours and has a lot of caramelization on it. It sort of tricks your tongue.
And it's also got some thyme in it too, right?
That's exactly right. So the combination of bay leaves and thyme leaves you with a really deep, deep flavor. And it's one of the things that you wouldn't necessarily think would give you such intense flavor, but really does in the end.
So one of your signature Ian Knauer tricks evidently is to use vanilla bean with herbs. What and how?
Yeah, so I actually like to use vanilla bean in a savory application. So let's say you're roasting a pork loin or something like that. You want to dry rub it with a bunch of herbs and spices. I would throw a piece of a vanilla bean, maybe half a vanilla bean, into a spice grinder, along with whatever other spices you have. Let's say it's coriander, cumin, thyme, black peppercorns, and then rub that on your piece of meat. Let that sit in there for a couple hours and sort of dry marinate, and then roast it off like you would normally, or grill it, or whatever you're going to do. The vanilla in there really gives it an intriguing note, and it doesn't taste like ice cream in the end. The vanilla sort of like blends in with the other herbs and becomes this incredibly complex flavor.
And we've got that recipe up on the Central Time Facebook page. Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
Such a pleasure to be with you.
We've been talking to Ian Knauer. He's a chef, TV host, and author. His latest cookbook is called The Farm.
You and I both nodded when he mentioned choking on bay leaves. Maybe we'll have to tell those stories sometime.
I had a near-death experience with the bay leaf, I swear, but I still like them.
Well, the first time I did it, I cut up the bay leaf and put it in my spaghetti sauce. And, of course, it doesn't. Anyway.
It doesn't cook
down. We both live to tell the tale.
True.